Welcome to the final event of the Visiting Writer Series. The Writer Series is brought to you by the College of Humanities and Sciences, the VCU Libraries, Barnes & Noble, and our reader tonight will be introduced by Harrison Fletcher.
It's a real pleasure for me to introduce Dinty W. Moore to VCU. I've been a fan for a really long time, and he's one of those writers who has made a pretty big impact on me. Although he might not say it himself, Dinty has been a guiding force in contemporary nonfiction going on about 20 years now. And although he's quite happy to describe himself as a, quote, respected but obscure American memoirist, you can pick up just about any essay anthology, craft guide, or conference brochure, and you'll see his name. You'll see, for instance, that he's the author of two acclaimed memoirs, Between Panic and Desire and Accidental Buddhist, A Guide to the Creative Process, The Mindful Writer, as well as three craft books, a short story collection, another nonfiction book, and more essays than I can name here. You'll also see that he's a professor of English and director of creative writing at Ohio University. And you'll see that he's editor of Brevity, one of the best literary magazines around, print or digital, bar none. But what you might not see are a few of the things that have made him the writer he is today. For instance, according to legend, Dinty was once a zookeeper who was nearly trampled by an elephant. He was also a street performer, an actor, a dancer, a filmmaker, and a reporter for United Press International. And among his long list of accomplishments, he proudly notes that he is, quote, a master of the short provocative status update. All of which to say is that he has acquired vast amounts of knowledge that he imparts in his latest work, Dear Mr. Essay Writer Guy, Advice and Confessions on Writing, Love, and Cannibals. If you're one of those writers who wants to know, after you've typed a period, if there's one space or two, consult his book. Or if you want to know, when you're writing your memoir on a cocktail napkin, how important is that cocktail, he's the man to ask. He's that deep. I myself have sampled that wisdom personally. A while back, when I aspired to be an obscure memoirist myself, me and another guy from Denver had the bright idea of starting our own magazine, a combination garage band, pirate rock radio station, and curio shop called Shadowbox. As we were trying to get the thing online, we set out to interview all writers with an eye toward where nonfiction was headed, as opposed to where it had been. High on our list was Dinty, who had written essays in the form of an alphabet, an autopsy report, a made-for-TV movie, a parable, and later a Google map and a Facebook conversation. If someone was going to show us what the cutting edge was, we thought, it would be him. So we bribed him with breakfast, I think it was. And Dinty graciously sat down to a lengthy one-on-one with my partner, John Michael Rivetta, during a Nonfiction Now conference in Iowa City. It was my job to transcribe the tape. Listening to his words over and over, cleaning up my typos, designing the page, proofreading for even more of my typos, a few things began to sink in. I found myself rethinking much of what I had supposed about creative nonfiction. Yes, Dinty said, he is drawn to explore form and content and the myriad expressions of the essay, but not in the way I thought he was. He wasn't interested in style for style's sake, or experimentation as an end to itself, or even art with a capital A. He was using structure, voice, negative space, and form as a method for self-exploration, as a way of making meaning, in service of clarity, in the pursuit of nonfiction truth. Listening to that tape and how he backed his way into the writing life after many jobs and experiences, I began to understand that the most important qualities for an essay and memoirist are not dizzying displays of kung fu craft, but honesty, bravery, accuracy, humility, and a healthy dose of compassion. Humor is medicine, Dinty said. Art is play. Sadly, Shadowbox has been mothballed to the attic, but I still keep that interview around as a reminder that being a writer is more than gathering bylines and prizes. It means that no matter how respectably obscure you might come, it's important to also be a good literary citizen, to make time, as he did, for guys like me. That's what writers do, he said. We help each other. So thank you, Mr. Essay Writer Guy. And maybe now you can answer a question that's been bothering me. So that comb-over thing on Donald Trump's head, is that an essay? So please help me welcome Dinty W. Moore.
It's going to be a hard introduction to live up to. I'm glad to be here at VCU. I'm glad to be here in Richmond. You have an amazing faculty here. You may or may not know that, but you do, and you have what, from all accounts I hear from outside, a really strong program. So it's nice to be here and see all of you. I checked, there's nothing on TV tonight, so I'm going to read for about 3 hours. lock the doors, please. An essay is an attempt, so I believe we're attempting to cover something on the Donald, so I suppose it is an essay. Though an essay is also supposed to lead the reader or viewer to think more deeply about things, so I don't know. It's an open question, but it's a good one. I'm going to read three short pieces tonight. I'm not going to read for 3 hours, just in case anybody didn't get the joke. All of them from Dear Mr. Essay Writer Guy. And the conceit of the book is that I asked some writers that I know to ask me questions, but I made it clear to them, I gave them strong signals that the book was going to be fairly tongue-in-cheek. So they asked me questions about love, about cannibals, about zebras, about writing, about cocktail napkins. Wrote a short answer in response and then wrote an essay as a longer response to the question. So this first question comes from an essayist named Philip Lopate. Dear Mr. Essay Writer Guy, I am curious how you deal honestly with male-female relations in general, and specifically your past girlfriends on the page, without coming off as a male chauvinist pig. Looking for guidance, Philip Lopate, New York City. No, I'm supposed to laugh at my jokes. That was his joke. Dear Philip, I believe the best way to avoid coming off as a male chauvinist pig might be to not be a male chauvinist pig. Is that a stretch? Another way might be to adopt a writing persona, perhaps one where you seem grateful, not vindictive or sour, and just vulnerable enough that the readers want to tuck you in and feed you soup. I've written an essay trying out my theory. I sip a cup of warm broth as I wrote it. You might try that as well. In mid-slurp, Mr. Essay Writer Guy. And this is the essay I wrote for Philip Lopate, attempting to answer his question about old girlfriends on the page. The title is Of Old Girlfriends. First of all, I am grateful, and I wish there had been more of you, but I fully understand. As a young man, I was distant, frightened, and naive. In retrospect, these are not traits that set a young girl's heart aflutter. I had all of the usual longings, of course, and occasionally dazzling amounts, but was somehow convinced by the Catholic Church that these biological impulses were mere evidence of my inherent wickedness. Even now, I'm at a loss to describe why other boys my age were able to deduce that the priests were spreading misinformed malarkey, while I stupidly swallowed the fiction, host, line, and sinker. But that was me, the brooding and stupid one, ready to believe that the soft, scented body of a gentle young woman was somehow a bouquet of poisoned sumac. My friends were less afflicted, and despite my confusion about women and love, I often tagged along on dates. My best friend in high school, Herkman, was a musician, and it was not uncommon for me to be tasked with keeping his girlfriend entertained while he fiddled with unreliable amplifiers, argued over chord progressions, smoked a little reefer in the keyboard player's van, and banged out a couple of sets on a Friday or Saturday evening. It was a classic division of labor. I chatted her up and made her laugh. Later, my friend Herkman French kissed her in the back of the Buick Skylark and felt around a bit under her bra. I had two girlfriends in high school. There is, of course, an excruciating difference between girlfriend and girlfriend. One of my girlfriends spoke to me on the phone for an hour almost every weeknight and I was profoundly in love. Lisa and I would chat about books sometimes, but usually we discussed her boyfriend, a lump of a young man and a star wrestler. "Do you think Matthew likes me?" she would ask halfway through every phone call. "Did he mention me at all in school today?" I would answer honestly and earnestly in detail, just to keep her on the line. If she heard my heart breaking, she probably thought it was just telephone static. My other girlfriend, Mary Carroll, had a screened-in back porch where she did her homework each afternoon, and once or twice a week I would ride my bike up her driveway and visit a while. She and I would discuss the fascinating artsy lives we hoped to lead someday, and often her mother would bring us out some iced tea. But Mary Carroll had boyfriends too, and they were also my classmates, and more often than not, I ended up again in the role of matchmaker. "Ronnie is so cute," she would say. "Don't you think?" I didn't think. I just brooded. Years later, at Mary Carroll's wedding reception, her mother called to me across four rows of tables at the Waterford Fire Hall. "I still think she should have married you, Dinty." Yeah, me too. The high school I attended was named the Cathedral Preparatory School for Young Catholic Boys. It was a prep school, preparing us for one of two futures, either playing football or spending our lives getting sucker punched by those who did play football. The girls in town all went to Villa Maria High, where they chiefly learned how to use safety pins to adjust the hems of their skirts, depending on whether they were in school, on the city bus, or hanging out downtown waiting for the football players to walk by. I'd like to think that this strict gender segregation contributed to my acute awkwardness, that if I had been in regular contact with young women my age, I would gradually have come to see them as human, accessible, similarly interested in exploring romance and budding sexuality. Instead, I was convinced that they were young nuns in training, and that they would slap me hard, like the nuns themselves, if they had even an inkling of what I wanted. I wanted to see them naked, and touch them, and then kiss them, and then marry them and worship them forever. Horrible stuff like that. I went to two proms, the first my junior year. I attended only because Lisa and Mary Carroll insisted. They even chose my date, Maureen, an extremely nice young girl who for some reason didn't appeal to me in the slightest. For one thing, she was from the wealthy part of town, and I bitterly resented those kids. For another, she was deeply religious. I should point out, for the sake of honesty and painful irony, that despite my total acceptance of the Catholic teachings on sexuality, I had pretty much rejected every other aspect of my assigned faith. I was the scourge of religion class, making the young priests earn their paltry wages by refuting my logical arguments against infallibility, original sin, virgin birth, and resurrection. "If God is all-powerful," I'd ask Father Humanet, "why did he need Judas to betray Jesus? I mean, he could have done what he wanted without all the drama. I doubt that Judas actually had any choice about turning Jesus over to the Roman soldiers, not when God's entire plan for the universe hinged on his decision." At this point, Father Humanet would have turned all red. "Really, Father," I would say, throwing up my hands in mock confusion, "it makes no sense." None of it made sense, actually, except for that part about my filthy masculine impulses. For some reason, that seemed spot on. As for Maureen, it wouldn't have been nice to not ask her to the prom, given the onslaught of phone calls from Lisa and Mary Carroll along the lines of, "Maureen is really, really waiting for you to ask her." Yes, along with all of my other unattractive traits, I was fastidiously polite. I didn't want to hurt Maureen's feelings, so I asked her, bought her a nice corsage, then treated her like an unwanted cousin all evening. No doubt I hurt her feelings more than if I hadn't called at all. 2 weeks before my senior prom, Eric, the keyboard player in my friend Herkman's band, broke up with his girlfriend Lori, whom I had loved from afar for months. Uncharacteristically, I found the guts to ask her to be my date, and amazingly, she accepted. I picked her up in my mother's green Plymouth Valiant, tried to think of clever things to say so she would laugh, and avoided holding her hand or dancing close in case she got the wrong impression about me. In any case, by midnight, Lori and Eric had spotted one another across the ballroom at Rainbow Gardens and said, "I'm sorry," with their eyes. By 1 a.m., she was back in his van. I have to assume she got home all right. College was different. The girls were older. Stephanie was elfish, beautiful, whip smart, and artistic, and I fell for her the moment we met. We dated, or hung out in a way I thought was dating, for most of my first semester, meaning we went to Marx Brothers or Woody Allen movies in the University of Pittsburgh Student Union, and then I walked her home, a good 2 miles into the residential center of Squirrel Hill. I loved those 2 miles and all the deep conversations we shared, and I especially enjoyed the modest kiss on her mother's porch before she slipped through the door. One night in late December, though, after a Christmas party in a friend's apartment, Stephanie looked at the snow falling thickly around us and said, "I'm too tired to walk. Why don't I stay in your room?" I thought, yes, and my heart raced. We slipped into my dorm. I gave her one of my big white t-shirts to wear in lieu of a nightgown. And then all night long, I didn't touch her, brush up against her, breathe heavily in her direction, or let on in any way that I was so erect I was about to explode. "If she sees what a gentleman I am," I reasoned, "she'll fall so much in love, she'll be mine forever." Yes, I had that exact thought. It would be hilarious if it weren't so pathetic. Not too long after, she was sleeping with my best friend, Peter. I couldn't blame them, though for about 2 years I did. No, I am not still a virgin. If I were, I wouldn't tell you. But I'm not. There was a young lady named Shelley, my junior year of college, who hung around my office in the student newspaper for weeks, dropping subtle hints, then not so subtle hints, then hints that resembled large hardwood tree trunks aimed at my thick forehead. Eventually, one thunderstormy Friday evening, she looked me directly in the eye and said, "You've never done this before, have you?" I shook my head, smiling like a shy toddler. She took matters into her own hands. She was lovely. To be honest, I'm not precisely sure if we grow wiser when we age, or just begin to see more clearly how ridiculous we were in our youth. Maybe it is all one and the same. The fun part of that is I had to get in touch with all of those women who I hadn't been in touch with for 30 plus, maybe more than 30 plus years. And they remembered a lot and helped me a lot with it. But Stephanie, elfish, whip smart, she was quite helpful, but boy, Peter was pissed off. He's the one that stole my girlfriend, but he was pissed off that I was writing about it. So this is fun. I shouldn't say that. This might be fun. You guys can let me know afterwards, because it's about the visiting writer. Also at University of Pittsburgh, it turns out. But I'm a visiting writer, so this, I don't know, is that ironic or just weird? So this question came from a writer who lives in Tucson now named Ander Monson. But he actually comes from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which I think he mentions in here. Here's Ander Monson's question to me. "Dear Mr. Essay Writer Guy, when I was in grad school, I took linguistics with the overly alliterative Dr. Dan Douglas, as he preferred not to be called. Instead, he asked us to call him Dan. He wore shorts exclusively year-round. This was in the upper Midwest, where it snows. Now, I teach my own class. I wear shorts a lot, this being Arizona. I've taken to wearing golf shirts, too. Dan gave me an A- in the class. I suspect he didn't believe in penalizing idiocy too strongly. Should I have received a lower grade? Should I stop wearing or writing shorts? And what are the risks of being the guy who always wears or writes shorts? Ander Monson, Tucson, Arizona." Dear Ander, yes, you should stop wearing shorts when you teach. Yes, your students paid me to say so. Also, shorts are important. No less a writer than Nelson Algren taught me that. Briefly, Mr. Essay Writer Guy." And here's the essay that goes with that question. The title is Nelson Algren's Shorts. Nelson Algren answered my knock with a low, tired groan. "Hang on," he eventually muttered through a thick wooden door. "One minute." The Chicago novelist was visiting the University of Pittsburgh to speak with young writing majors. It was April 1977, and I was one of these young writers, and Algren's escort as well. I had been instructed to do whatever it was that our honored guest desired. So I waited dutifully in the hallway outside of his hotel room and practiced what I would say when he came to the door. Algren, author of novels like A Walk on the Wild Side and Man with a Golden Arm, winner of the 1950 National Book Award, had been called the best contemporary author after William Faulkner. Ernest Hemingway himself had said that, so I knew it had to be true. And Algren's reputation extended beyond his writing. He made his name chronicling the seamier sides of Chicago, the pimps, prostitutes, petty thieves, con men, addicts, derelicts, and cheats. Algren was rumored to be part of the action, a bit of a tough guy himself. Maybe we would search out Pittsburgh's secret crap games and wily bookmakers, I thought as I waited outside his door that morning. Maybe we would place a few smart bets. My plan was to just stay quiet and put my money wherever Algren put his. Or perhaps, it occurred to me, we would simply screw the top off a pint of rye and sit along the copper-colored Monongahela River. He would tell some stories, offer me some advice. My wait in that hallway extended far beyond the 1 minute Algren had suggested. A grown man could have shaved and dressed in the time I stood waiting. Perhaps one did. When the heavy door swung open, the man facing me looked much older than the book jacket picture I had carefully scrutinized in the weeks leading up to Nelson Algren's visit. The novelist's green suit was worn, oversized, begging for a dry cleaner. He wore white socks with brown shoes. His face was pale, his eyes slightly yellow, and he rather needed a haircut. I'd expected movie star good looks, gold watches and diamond pinky rings, an Italian suit at the very least. But looks can be deceiving, I reminded myself. Forgetting in the moment my carefully prepared introductory speech, the one where I made it clear to him that I was something special, not just some college kid escort, but a college kid escort who was going to be a real writer someday, I managed to utter a mere, "Hello, Mr. Algren." Then, "What would you like to do today, Mr. Algren?" My voice was chirpy, I think, rather than authoritative. Though my goal was to appear both worldly and eager, I'm sure I came off as simply silly. But I caught myself, remembered my purpose, and screwed up enough nerve to speak a third time. I informed Algren that I owned a car, and that we had the entire afternoon and early evening free. Algren reached down, pulled up the hand I had been too nervous to extend his way, and shook it firmly. "I want to buy underwear," he growled. "Take me somewhere I can buy some shorts." For a moment, I just didn't respond. Was he speaking in code? My mind tried to put together underwear with something daring and incorrigible, something more in keeping with the world of Algren's books. Maybe, just maybe, the underwear would be ladies' underwear, and still on the ladies. Perhaps shorts meant something different in Chicago than it does in Pittsburgh. Eventually, I managed a firm, "Excuse me? I need to go someplace and buy underwear. I don't have a single clean pair." "Underwear, Mr. Algren?" "Yeah, shorts." Algren and I set off, on foot, for a Woolworth's 5 and 10 that morning. As we ambled along Forbes Avenue, I tossed out a few astute facts about the campus buildings we passed, but clearly he wasn't interested. Algren walked at a steady clip for a man in his late 60s. This surprised me, being 21 and ignorant. "Are we close?" he asked after about 5 minutes. "Just one more block, Mr. Algren." This seemed to please him, and he smiled slightly the rest of the walk. We entered Woolworth's, which is very much like entering the past. The store was on its last legs, dimly lit, poorly staffed, an eager candidate for urban renewal. We stepped down 3 short steps to the retail area, and the famous American novelist snatched the first package of men's shorts he saw. 3 white boxers, about a 36 waist. I hung back, embarrassed, not wanting anyone to connect me with the old man. "Now take me home," he said. We retraced our steps briskly, me holding in my disappointment and Algren hugging his Woolworth's bag. Along the way, scanning the businesses along Forbes, Algren spotted Frankie Gustine's, a smoky tavern named for a former Pittsburgh Pirates infielder. Algren knew the name. He suddenly wanted a drink, so we went in. I asked for a beer. "Bring the boy a martini," Algren ordered the bartender. "Excuse me?" I asked. But no one was listening, least of all the fellow behind the bar, who seemed to sense immediately that this was not some old man with a bag full of Woolworth's boxers, but a man of some consequence and gravity. When the drinks came in tall-stemmed, chilled glasses, Algren showed his first real interest in me. "You had one of these before?" he asked. "No," I said. He seemed fascinated by this idea, the boy in his first martini, and eyed me closely while I sipped, demanded to know my reaction immediately. I lied and said the drink was good, though in truth it tasted to me like vinegar and urine. I regret to this day that I didn't tell him that. He might just have laughed. We had one martini each, and Algren lectured me on why a martini was the proper thing to drink. His reasoning had to do with the seriousness of drinking. A real drink was a real drink, he told me, while a beer was just water with a little bit of booze mixed in. "You look like an amateur," he warned me. I was, and mostly we sat in silence, studying the back of the bar. There wasn't much a man like Algren could possibly want to know about a green college kid writer, and I could no longer imagine what questions I might ask him. At the bottom of the drink, Algren said, "Finished." So we exited and walked back towards his room, slightly drunk. I was slightly drunk, that is. I don't know about Algren. His step had slowed some. He was still quiet, but he was probably fine. I followed him into the Webster Hall lobby, into the elevator and up to his floor, and then stood outside the big wooden door again. He shook my hand, assured me he would find his way to the student union that evening entirely on his own. I was about to go, but he had some trouble with the key and the lock. My hand was steadier, so I opened the door for him, watched his back as he ambled into the surprisingly small and shabby room. I remember feeling embarrassed that we had put him there. A remarkable man like this deserves a nicer room and a better escort and someone with a better sense of what he might need. He was not the man I had imagined he would be. He was just a writer of enormous talent. After the door was open, Algren turned my way one last time. "Thanks," he said. "I had a good time." He was across the room, undressing for his afternoon nap, before I even shut the door. Last question comes from a writer in Los Angeles named Dinah Lenny, who is an amazingly wonderful memoirist and writer, but also was Nurse Betty on ER for many, many years and appears in the HBO series, one of those HBO series that you love. I'm just fascinated that she had that career as a Hollywood actress and also writes so well. Her question is, "Dear Mr. S.A. Writer Guy, is there anything you won't write about? Anything too private? Would you admit it if there were?" Dinah Lenny, Los Angeles, California. And then I write her an enormously long answer, which is very dull. If you buy my book, skip that part. Which pretty much explains that at one point in my life, I tried to write a book about my teenage daughter. Teenage then, she's no longer a teenager. Based on a book called Reviving Ophelia, which was a wonderful book, sort of outlining how our culture, certainly our media culture, creates false expectations and lots of problems for young women trying to conform to what is an unreasonable, in fact, impossible image to conform to. The book was brilliant. It is brilliant. It doesn't mention fathers much. I thought, well, I'll write the book from the point of view of the father. I spent 3 years writing the book. I had a contract from a nice publisher. Publisher read the book, said, "Nah, doesn't work." I spent 2 years rewriting it from front to back, answering the publisher's questions about why it didn't work. Publisher looked at it and said, "Nah, still doesn't work." And I went to my agent in New York shortly thereafter and said, "What are we going to do here?" And she said, "Oh, just put that book away." You know, I wanted to kill her, but her secretary was right outside. And it turned out to be the smartest thing anybody ever said to me, even though at the time I just wanted to die. 6 years of hard work on a book that never saw the light of day, and for good reason, and I don't know if I'll go into why, other than the fact that I didn't do a very good job with the book, and it's very hard to write about your own child. And she will tell you, I shouldn't give too much away, that I had no frickin' idea what I was talking about. But here's the good news, okay? 6 years, I think I probably wrote and revised 450 pages. I came out with an 8-page essay that pretty much says everything I wanted to say in the book. And it only took me 6 years to write. And And if you can count to 20, you can also keep track of how close we are to finishing this. So the essay is called Pulling Teeth, or 20 Reasons Why My Daughter Turning 20 Can't Come Soon Enough. And if you're interested, all the science in here is accurate, teeth and cavemen and such. Pulling Teeth, or 20 Reasons Why My Daughter Turning 20 Can't Come Soon Enough. 1. Here's an interesting fact. Homo erectus, our 1.5 million-year-old evolutionary antecedent, skipped right over the teenage years, proceeding directly from cave kid to cave adult. 2. Researchers figured this out by taking cross-sections of fossilized teeth. Markings on tooth enamel, it turns out, are much like tree rings. They tell us, for instance, that what modern human parents experience as an extended, oftentimes interminable period of adolescence only developed about a half million years ago. 3. Our ancestors were, in this way, like modern apes. Young apes tend to break the apron strings much earlier than humans. By the time a female chimpanzee has reached her early teen years, she can make her own nest and locate her own bananas. 4. More importantly, if a day filled with grooming her simian cousins, gnawing on twigs, and swinging from branch to branch to attract boy chimps leaves a female teen chimp feeling somehow unfulfilled, she doesn't blame anyone but herself. 5. My point. Someone should yank the teeth out of every teenage boy in my daughter's high school classroom. I have names and addresses if anyone is interested. 6. My other point. These same scientists should pull a few girl molars as well, gently, and put these female teeth under a microscope. My hope here is that these molarologists will discover that some new invisible change is now underway. After all, if teenagers can evolve once, they can surely evolve again, perhaps evolve to some point where this prickly adolescent stage becomes entirely unnecessary. 7. I have a female teenager at home. The other day, I picked up a piece of paper on the table next to my favorite chair. "Don't look at that," my female teenager shouted. So I quickly returned the paper to the desk, announced, "Sorry, I didn't know it was private." She huffed, "Of course it's private." What I seemed to be looking at in the few short moments before I was bullied into putting it back down was a line drawing of a young woman in a dress. I think the point of the artwork was the dress, an elaborate original bit of haute couture. The design, by the way, was drawn on my tablet with my pencil. "How was I to know the drawing was private?" I asked, foolishly trying to remain in my daughter's good graces. My female teenager just glared at me, the way teenagers will glare when you have them dead to rights, when they know you're correct and they hate you for it. "Listen," she said firmly, "from now on, just assume that everything I do is private." 8. I am not a perfect father. Instead, I'm the hang-in-there type, meaning that I have almost no idea what I am doing, but over the years, I've hung in there, plugging onward, trusting that instinct or perhaps just dumb luck will get me through. Female teenagers, of course, naturally crave a level of distance from their embarrassing, fragrant, loutish fathers. So lately, I've given my daughter extra space. Girls, after all, do have the right to privacy. And here, then, is the rub. That space quickly begins to seem a distance, and that distance soon enough resembles a gulf. Before you know it, neither party can step across. 9. Down this road are any number of horrible outcomes. I know. I've imagined them all. 10. I had the good fortune to take my female teenager to Madrid last summer. Now, admittedly, Madrid in July includes surly crowds, fearsome traffic, and scorching pavement. But still, come on, this was Europe, the capital of Spain, museums, cafes, fashion. My female teenager just moped for most of the trip, primarily because her feet hurt, and she didn't take it all well to Spanish cuisine. "Why aren't you having fun?" I inquired. This is an absolutely brainless question to ask someone who seems not to be having fun. But I asked it, nonetheless, more than once. "Jesus Christ," she answered. "Get over it." I persisted, stupidly imagining that I could somehow talk my daughter out of her bad humor. "You know," I said, in a calm, parental voice. It's hard for me to have a good time when I look over, and you just seem so damned miserable. She chewed on my words a moment, gave them careful consideration. Then she looked up, met my eyes, said, "That's your problem." "11. That is my problem. 12. I wish someone had taken me to Europe when I was young. 13. That's my problem, too. 14. But I don't know what she wants or what I'm supposed to do. How do I remain a constructive influence on my teenage female human while being systematically frozen out of every aspect of her teenage female life? How do I please someone who resents my very existence? How do I parent someone whose only wish is that I go far, far away? How do I continue in the face of that? How do I stop trying? Parents, especially embarrassing male parents, can be a drag sometimes, but they are a biological necessity. And as much as I'd like to apologize to my female teenager for the inconvenient reality of sperm and egg and family, it is not my fault, not really. I'm not the one who came up with it. 15. Darwin had 10 children, but interestingly, he didn't take any of them along to the islands. 16. So I'm back to the teeth and evolution. Maybe, just maybe, evolution is continuing even now, and maybe female teenagers are developing beyond this tendency towards prickly unreasonableness. Perhaps this whole problem will be remembered as just a 500,000-year aberration, a necessary but ridiculous step along the evolutionary continuum. 17. Or possibly, like those Galapagos finches Darwin was so fond of, parents themselves will adapt new beaks, allowing them to break open this tougher seed coating more easily. 18. As for my daughter, she will stop being a teenager eventually. She will turn 20. I've heard that can happen. 19. For now, though, just getting my female teenager to speak to me is like, well, like pulling teeth. 20. And I don't like pulling teeth. It tends to be painful on both ends. Thank you.